for those recording the session. I'm Doug Thorpe. I teach at Seattle Pacific University. And this is a bonus session. It's like these days, you buy a CD and there's maybe a bonus track that didn't quite fit in the theme of the whole CD, but it was good, and they didn't want to leave it out. So this is the bonus track on The Labyrinth and The Brothers Karamazov. Question is, how are we going to, in 60 minutes, somehow talk about both The Labyrinth and this 850-page novel? So we're going to have to find out how we do that. So there's a handout going around, and if we get there, which is my plan, there's one section. Are we short? Because I have a few more. There are a few more, and if you don't have one, you could share.
We'll share.
And in that packet, there's one section that includes these pages, 555 to 556. Or actually, I guess it's 556 to 557. My apology. 556 to 557. So if you want to be ready.
Don't you want to make copies?
How short are we?
I don't know.
Sure. So here's what you all want to do is make a copy of just that page.
Is there a magic code?
There's no magic code. You just go up to the copier, stick it in, and press the button. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. All right. And we have a loaf of Labyrinth bread. Made by Grace back there, who's been working up here this summer, which we can share at the end of class if you wish to. Actually,
an extra bonus.
An extra bonus. This is more like those TV commercials where you sign up for the weightlifting set or something, and we will send, if you were to write now, we will send you also in addition this 500-page book that tells you how to use this equipment. And not only that, but if you call within the next 30 seconds, we will send you the person who will insist that you actually use this equipment.
I watch the guys at the fair that do it. They've got it down to a science.
They do. They
just play one growth and it's unbelievable.
Yeah. All right. And as occasionally last week, I want to begin with this poem, Prayer from Hildegard of Bingen. Holy Spirit, giving life to all life, moving all creatures, root of all things, washing them clean, wiping out their mistakes, healing their wounds, you are our true life, luminous, wonderful, awakening the heart from its ancient sleep. Amen. Awakening the heart from its ancient sleep. The Holy Spirit awakening the heart. Beautiful, beautiful phrase. Love that notion. That we're somehow asleep, collectively asleep, and we need to be awakened. To me, this again is another way of talking about a prophetic act, is to wake us up. I'm William Blake, scholar.
From Newton's sleep.
Blake. Yes, we're awakening from Newton's sleep. Yes, God keep us from single vision and Newton's sleep. So somehow trying to wake us up. I'm a great believer in the power of literature and poetry to do something like that. And that's why I wanted to talk about Brothers Karamazov all last week, because I think that book is a beautiful way. But I'm also a lover of the Labyrinth, and I love walking the Labyrinth out here. I'm from St. Mark's Cathedral. That's my parish in Seattle. And we also are a community that uses, in this case, a canvas labyrinth. And sometimes we put it out in the center of the nave, move pews out, put the labyrinth in the center of the nave, and the nave is a little bit like this. It's a, It's a square. So imagine this very large, shark-style labyrinth in the middle of the nave. It's aesthetically alone, it's a beautiful thing to see. It shapes the space. It makes the space cohere in a certain way. So I want to begin with this question. First of all, how many of you are familiar with a labyrinth or have walked a labyrinth? Most of you. Okay, that's terrific. That's right. So I don't have to spend a lot of time talking about that. So my next question is, what does the labyrinth have to do with Christ?
With what?
With Christ, with Jesus. What does the labyrinth have to do with Jesus? If anything, and the answer may be nothing at all. Although here it is at Holden, this Lutheran institution. If it's an institution, I don't know, is that fair, Karen? Is it an institution?
I think it's indefinable.
It is indefinable. I've been thinking a lot about this, and this again goes back to the prophets. And you know, I have a sense that the church, as an institution, really the best thing it should do is be continually, daily subverting itself as an institution. That's its task. And Holden, I think, does a pretty good job of that. Or Holden is a community. I think Tom calls it an unintentional or non-intentional community. So yeah, Christ in the labyrinth. Yeah. Right?
No, I was...
You need a copy.
I do labyrinths with my kids, and we're always in this conversation about labyrinths and mazes.
Mm-hmm.
And think about Christ in the labyrinth, that walking the labyrinth, it surprises you, it doesn't go where you expect it to.
Okay.
But you can always trust it. It's not going to trick you, and it'll take you to the center.
Right. Okay, so surprise is part of it. You even used the word trick. Kind of interesting. It's not a maze.
It doesn't trick you.
It doesn't trick you. Okay, it doesn't trick you. No tricks.
It surprises you.
Okay. It can be a surprise, but no tricks. Labyrinths, the way the people who are doing this kind of labyrinth work define it is that it is a universal path. It has one path. It is not a maze, meaning that there are no dead ends. Right? It is one road, one path. So that notion of path or way is, of course, a central metaphor in the labyrinth. It is a kind of path. Yeah.
I don't know whether this is particularly Christian, but it could be if you chose it to be. And that's the idea that there is a divine walking with you, in you and with you,
mm-hmm.
towards the center.
Okay. Some sense that as you're walking, this divine is walking with you and in you, as part of you, even. That,
the beauty of it is it can be a metaphor for anything you choose it to be a metaphor for.
Just about, yeah. No, that's why as a lit prof, I love it. Because, yeah, it's just endless in terms of how you can play with it. I bring the St. Mark's Labyrinth, which is on campus, I bring to Seattle Pacific University, and as some of you know, it's an evangelical Christian institution, very conservative theologically, and every day before Thanksgiving, I bring the labyrinth over, and I have a group of freshmen, and one of the requirements is that everybody come over and walk the labyrinth the day before Thanksgiving. And this is an action that, for some of the students, is definitely pushes their boundaries. They are not familiar with it. It's a little scary. It can seem a little pagan, possibly, a little pagan. But the surprising thing is, possibly have a testimony here. I don't know, Grace, do you want to respond to this?
Well, I mean, what am I responding to? I can imagine that a lot of the perception of it was pagan or non-Christian.
Sure, yeah. And I think that's the case. But surprisingly, a number of the students having done it, they come out and they just, some of them it's just very peaceful. There's a lot of stress, you're getting near the end of the quarter, Thanksgiving, they're going home. And it's just a stress release. But for some of them, it's a very profound experience. Right? And again, trying to put it into words, there is a sense of walking with Jesus, or you know, there's an entry point, there's a threshold, this liminal place, and you enter in and you're winding around. I'm not drawing it correctly because it's much more complicated than that, but very much a sense of moving towards a center. Moving towards a center. Even though it's a wandering process, that's the feeling. Yeah.
What phrase that I think comes to mind is common yet different. In other words, you know, you have the sense that other people have trodden the same path, but yet everybody experiences it differently.
Yes.
So being open to that, that difference.
Yeah, common and yet different. I had these words, individual and community. And so everybody is walking their own path, so to speak, their own way. And that's one of the things, like, when people are instructing them on the labyrinth, they say very clearly, this is your walk. Mm-hmm. You can do it any way you want to. Kids will just start here and sometimes run into the middle and run out, or run all around it and so on. And there are people who are very frustrated by that. Oh, those kids. They're getting in the way of my walk, my spiritual walk. Right? And of course, the irony is that those kids are really there to teach them something about their own bloodiness. Right? There's an opportunity. Of course, the church itself had that problem. There were labyrinths in Europe in many places. And in some of the cathedrals, the labyrinths were taken out because the kids were playing on the labyrinth.
Well, in Chartres, very shortly after it was built, there were complaints that it was just for the idol and for children.
Sure, yeah.
And of course, he had a minotaur in the center of it.
Yeah. And that, of course, I'm hoping we'll get to that whole question. That whole question. Because, yeah, it is a pagan myth.
Where did it originate?
Well, there have been labyrinths in cultures all over the world, variations on labyrinths in cultures all over the world. Certainly, southwestern United States, Navajo and so on. Scandinavia, many, many old forms of labyrinths. So it does seem to be an archetype if you want to. The labyrinth, the Christian labyrinth, seems to be a transformation in some ways of the Greek story. And how many are familiar with the story of Theseus entering the labyrinth in Crete and so on? Yeah, I mean, that story, I guess we could get into that right now. In that story, Theseus comes down from Athens. This at least is my memory of the story. And the king of Crete, Minos, has constructed this labyrinth and placed the Minotaur in the center of it. The Minotaur is half animal, half human, and is a creator. This is complicated. The Minotaur is the child of Minos, the king of Crete's wife, and a white bull that she fell in love with. And she had a bull costume created for her by the great craftsman architect Daedalus, so that she could have sex with this bull, and the Minotaur is the result. The white bull was a holy creature of the gods that was offered to Minos. He was supposed to slaughter it. It is a sacrificial animal. And what does Minos do instead? In a sense, he falls in love with it, you could say. It's so beautiful that rather than sacrificing it, he tries to keep it for himself. He wants to own it. Those of you who were here last week and heard the story in The Brothers Karamazov of Peeling a Little Onion, it's a similar sort of thing. That is, this notion of possession, as we all know, what happens when we possess something is that it comes to possess us. course, is horrified by the creation of this Minotaur, and so places it in the center of this elaborate labyrinth to hide it away, and also then offers up children from Athens, because he has dominated Athens, has subjugated Athens to his will, and they have to send kids down to Crete to be sacrificed to the Minotaur. So there is this endless procession, you might say, of violence, sacrificial violence, which is one way to try to appease the gods. And Theseus finally comes down, who, of course, is the hero of the story, and the daughter of Minos falls in love with her, Ariadne, and provides Theseus with a secret weapon, which is a thread, that leads him, allows him to enter into the labyrinth, to arrive at the center, and to find his way back out. So that labyrinth is more maze-like, really. But he is able to enter into the center. And of course, what does he do in the center as the hero? What do heroes do?
He kills the Minotaur.
He kills the monster. And we still live with these stories. There are monsters out there. How do we deal with them? A half an hour ago, I was over in Narnia with the 4 to 10-year-olds. And this may have been a terrible mistake, but let's just stop right there. Meeting with them may have been a terrible mistake. I did this on Monday, too, and just to tell stories and to share what stories are about. And what we did was we took some words, put them on the board, associated with Holden, a lot of animals. That's immediately what those kids did. They didn't throw the word community out. They didn't say compassion. They didn't say, they said chipmunks. That was the first. Mice, deer, bear. And so what we did was we started a story in one sentence. Once upon a time, there were these children who lived out in the forest with their mother and their father and their grandparents, community. And they lived in peace out there with the deer and the mice and the chipmunks and the bear and the fish. And then, begin in Eden, something happens, and the question is, how do we find our way back to this place that somewhere in our hearts we know exists? All stories in some way. You know, lit people will say, you know, every story, Aristotle, every story has a conflict, either physical or psychological, spiritual, some kind of conflict. That's plot. Otherwise, I guess it's boring. But that's our story. How do we get back? Joan Mitchell, Woodstock. How do we get back to the garden? And what happened? Then I said, something happened. And then it was up to the kids. It's your story. And the first thing that happens is there are evil chipmunks. Evil chipmunks, and we're off and running, and it just eventually turns into chaos. Unfortunately, I'm out of there. So there are these stories, these patterns that we find ourselves in the midst of. And the labyrinth is that, you know, there are these individual stories, and we are walking it alone. This is what you're told. You walk it in your own way. And yet, at the same time, there's one path. I mean, it's such a beautiful metaphor in some ways for the Christian story. Each of us walks our own way, but in some fundamental sense, I think we feel there is one path. And it gets tricky, of course, teaching it an evangelical institution, as soon as I say one path, I'm going to get John, was it John 14:6? Echoed back to me. Ah, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. Bingo! It's solved. Well, then you've got all those other people who are burning in hell. I mean, as soon as I'm going to start ranting. You probably know where I'm going. Fortunately, students do raise these questions, and we have a chance to kind of unpack that. So it may be that Christ you speak of, or that way, that path, is very big. But it's not relativistic. We also have a sense that there is right and wrong. We know it, we know when we're off, when we're just off-center, when we're off-kilter. We know that in some way. Or at least eventually we wake up to it. The beginning of the Divine Comedy, another story just like this. Dante, very beginning, midway through the journey of our life, Nostra Vita, our life, I found myself lost in the dark woods, the selva oscura. The selva, the woods, oscura, obscured, something you cannot see your way through. And the story begins there because he actually woke up out of his ancient sleep and realized that, my gosh, I don't have a as to where I am. So, yeah.
That was me yesterday, walking the labyrinth for the first time. And then I got to the center, and I had no idea what I was supposed to do then.
Ah, okay.
And it was sort of like, do I walk all the way back around? Do I just make a run for it? Or what? So.
Yeah. You know, that's because there were those evil chipmunks.
So what do you do when you get to the middle? How do you get out? Is that, again, our own choice, or?
That's an excellent question.
You hope you're not there with someone who's doing the sun salutations at the same time.
You know, whatever pushes your body, that's what the labyrinth is there to teach you. Yeah.
I think one of the things that fascinates me about the labyrinth, well, in the past that I've done it, this one and other labyrinths, being who I am, I usually get off the path, and then I get all fouled up, and then I have to jump around to get to the middle. But this time was kind of interesting because one of the things I noticed about the labyrinth was that it, I think when I did labyrinths before, I knew that there was a center, and I was going to get to the center somehow, and I couldn't see the way because of the plant, you're not tall enough to see down on it. But I think what was interesting about it this time is that I saw how many times the path had proximity. It would go toward the center, and it would come away. And there was that, it was that constant weaving, not only going to it, but away from it. But the other thing that was interesting, not only did it have a relationship to the center, but it had a relationship to the past, the path. And actually,
past
is... And it was interesting because I was thinking about my life and looking backwards on it as opposed to just forwards. And the labyrinth was really interesting that way because, in a sense, one could become reflective of one's path.
Yes.
And I don't think I'd really ever experienced that before, its relationship to the center quite that way.
And the way you're describing this, and again, if you go back to this Greek myth and think about Theseus, it's a very different relationship with that process than we imagine Theseus having, who is anticipating having to slay a monster in the middle and so on and so forth. There's something a little bit different about that. Now, going back to using that, again, this question about, so what does the labyrinth have to do with Christ? Yeah. Do you have that hand? You're weaving. She's knitting. She's knitting. And I'm not going to touch it.
Don't mess with it.
Don't mess with it. At least it's not a laptop, right?
Yeah.
So, what's striking is, and this is the way this is sometimes explained, that what Christianity does, of course, is take over pagan things, use the symbols, and transform them in some way. Christmas itself is not exactly biblical. It's not. You read the Matthew, Gospel of Matthew, and on December 25th, Jesus. 5th is very close to the winter solstice. And so you have the birth of light, of course, coming at the darkest time of the year. It's a very powerful archetypal image. Just as you have John the Baptist's day is June 24th. And so you have this balance between John the Baptist, who says, essentially, he must increase and I must decrease. Well, it's the longest day of the year. And so literally what's happening following John the Baptist is that he is decreasing in order to allow space. He is emptying himself the way Christ ultimately does as a sign for the one who is to come. It's very beautiful the way the church calendar is set up like that. It's you know, very much based on this, you know, natural calendar. I happen to have been married on John the Baptist's day, which is a sort of odd day for a marriage. So the difference is that you have Theseus going in and slaying the monster. And if in traditional, in a Christian understanding of the labyrinth, rather than meeting the Minotaur at the center, we meet whom?
God.
We meet God in the form of
Christ. Or rocks.
Maybe not so funny. Yeah. Certainly in the Northwest, at least, where our spirituality tends to be a natural spirituality, it might well be that you meet God in the form of these rocks.
Or Ahab meets the whale.
There you go. Yeah. Ahab meets the whale. I mean, there is a possibility of meeting a monster. It is a possibility.
The monster inside, too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. See, that's the thing. That's the shift, isn't it? That there's you could call it a psychological or spiritual translation of the myth. So that there is some sense in which, in walking the labyrinth, one of the invitations is to meet that monster. And it might just be in the form of those kids who are playing around in the labyrinth and raising your hackles. Right? And so there's an opportunity to stop and say, whoa, that's interesting. I'm really pissed that these kids are here. Right? And is that, you know, is it the problem with the kids? Or is it something with me that, you know, wants to clear them off the labyrinth so that I can have my holy walk? And so, yeah, you know, we meet our stuff. Or it could be as simple as there's someone in front of you who's moving so slowly. And I, you know, and then you go around them or whatever. But you just suddenly are faced with yourself. So, yeah, there is a monster. And so slaying the monster, how is that monster slain? If we're putting it into a Christian context, that should be pretty clear. If the hero, if the walker in the labyrinth is not Theseus but Christ, how does he slay the monster?
If you were a Jungian, you might embrace the monster.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes. You might recognize it. You might try to see it and own it in that sense. Absolutely. Yeah. Is that what Jesus does? How does he defeat it?
Through giving his own sacrifice.
Okay. So rather than killing, he becomes the sacrificial lamb. And that's the language we use, of course. And however we want to try to understand that, there's something about that shift. Theseus kills the Minotaur, and Jesus allows himself to be, which is a sign of what? So the sign becomes what? What's the meaning of that? I don't know how we got into theological terms, but we did. Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to say that Jesus was the sacrifice, then who is he sacrificing himself for or in lieu of? And that, according to Christian theology, would be us.
Yes.
And therefore, we are the Minotaur. It's being redeemed through this sacrifice.
Very sweet. Yeah, okay.
Not that I agree with that necessarily.
And it depends on how you understand that happening. Right. And one answer, of course, is the atonement.
Sure.
You know, God is really mad. We've done such terrible things. And so he needs a sacrificial victim to set things right. But on the other hand, what Jesus says is, You want to follow me? How do you do that? You pick up your cross. Which seems to suggest that not just, oh, thank you, Jesus, for doing this, so I don't have to do anything. Instead, here's the deal. The sign is that this is the way of things. This is the way of reality. This is the way of truth. This is the way of knowledge. There's something sacrificial or something. This is, you could say, the nature of love.
So does Jesus, in a sense, become the Minotaur?
In what sense do you think that would be the case?
Well, if he becomes the sacrifice.
Or certainly reveals the nature of it. It's interesting. You know, the word monster, the root of the word monster, actually is connected to the notion of showing or image or seeing things. And there's also a related word, monstrum. What is a monstrum? Those who are liturgically oriented. I think this is the word I'm thinking of. Don, is this familiar?
I think you mean another word, but it's not coming to me right now.
Okay.
Monstrance.
Monstrance, thank you. Right. That's what I'm thinking of, the monstrance. Yeah, which is what?
It's the vehicle through which you transport a holy wafer or exhibit it.
Yes. Yeah. How curious. That you could get from monster to monstrance or vice versa.
Yeah, I think of the word demonstrate.
Say root.
You demonster it.
Yes. Yeah. You are showing. That's demonstrating. You are showing something, revealing something. Yeah.
The thing that comes to my mind that's important is that there's an acknowledgement of it, of the monster. And the other part of it, to me, that's important is that one actually can't or doesn't exist as natural law without the other. And that in a way, I think of Jesus creating a balance. Because if the monster is really large and you're totally afraid of it and don't know it, that's an imbalance in itself. And if you can absorb it and accept it and live with that dichotomy of dark and light within yourself,
yes,
it's a strength.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's still Jungian there. But
yeah.
It's all right. The center of the labyrinth, you can name the monster.
Yes.
If you name it, well, then you can understand it. You can look at it and overcome it if you need to.
Yeah. I think it does have something to do with that. And the cross, it makes sense. Because there, what we're looking at is the fact that we murder our prophets. We kill our innocent. We, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's pretty powerful. And of course, you know, it's the people who shout out, crucify him, crucify him. At the cathedral, this is what we used to do, right? You know, at that point in the gospel story, the parish would cry out those words so that you would, in some ways, take ownership for that experience. So it allows us to see what we do. Yeah, and there's something powerful about that. And the labyrinth works in that territory. It is an invitation to see ourselves. To recognize ourselves. And so paradoxically, we are kind of walking into a center where there's a monster. And yet, when we get there, what we may really experience is not so much a monster as the Christ, as this sense of light, as a sense of freedom, forgiveness. If we have, in a sense, owned our stuff, if there is confession, and with that word, I'm making a segue to the Brothers Karamazov, where the idea of confession is so important. One character, one brother says to another, I want you to listen, to judge, and to forgive. He's going to tell his story to his brother. He's going to speak honestly. And there's potentially something healing about that. And I'm coming back to this notion of, well, how does the cross heal? Is it an atonement process? the word salvation. I'm doing all this etymology today. I forgive me. But I love words. I love the roots of words. There's something by digging down a little bit, speaking metaphorically again, I think we learn something about the deeper meaning of those words. And salvation shares a Latin root, salve, meaning healing. So one way of talking about this salvation process, really, it's a healing process. It's like a salve you put on a wound to help it heal. So that's what's going on. And we walk this path, and that path is our story. And it's our past, it's our memories, it's what we've done. And at least for me, there's also something about the pattern. That's why I have these words up here. It's not just random. Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm going to go back a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think an important part of the process of moving through the story is, and it relates to the prophets that we've talked about, is the sort of truth-telling.
Yes.
Because it's like a wound. Until you get the wound open and really see what's there,
yes,
honestly, you face it, you can't actually, healing can't happen.
Yes. And I think that two things are happening simultaneously. And this is hypothesis in a way. Because I spent, as a teacher and a writer, I'm struggling all the time with this sense of, on the one hand, really needing to do that. And on the other hand, feeling that there's something about the way things are told matters. The words we use matter. The pattern of the words matter. I think one reason we have the prophets we have is because they were poets as well. The language is so powerful, so beautiful, that it stays with us. And some of it is literally poetry. That passage you pulled out of Amos today. Just, it is literally poetic. And so the poetry stays with us in some sense. And so the labyrinth is simultaneously this walking into our truth. But it is also this pattern, this matrix or field, as we are weaving, and that's the word that comes up a lot, as we're weaving our way through this pattern, left, right, to me at least, there's something beautifully aesthetic about that experience that also feels healing. A friend of ours from the cathedral who was here last week is a piano teacher and also a labyrinth walker, and she has a two-handed labyrinth that she uses, and it's partly for counseling and so on. But she had a piano student who simply couldn't find a way to play with her left hand and her right hand at the same time. She could do one or the other, but couldn't do them together. So what she did was, she took this labyrinth, where there's a labyrinth here and a labyrinth here. She turned it sideways, so she's got a labyrinth here and a labyrinth here. And having the student not say a word, she had her take her fingers and trace left hand, right hand through that whole pattern, whole process. And then the student sat down at the piano, played effortlessly with both hands.
Wow.
So there was something about, call it obviously, left brain, right brain, getting into sync. And I do think that there is something about the labyrinth process that works upon us just in terms of the way our minds work. Some fundamental physiological, biochemical way. I think the labyrinth does work that way. And so the pattern that we walk, you know, feels good. There's a rightness about that pattern as we're walking it. There's a kind of wholeness about it. And of course, that's where the metaphors also come in. You start at the outside, you weave your way around, it's one path, and you arrive at a center. And that sense, it's a felt sense, it's a bodily sense, it's not just intellectual. It is a felt sense of arriving at a center. And then, yes, you work your way traditionally, you work your way back up. It is really not much different than going to church on Sunday morning, hearing the gospel, sharing the peace, sharing Eucharist, and then what happens? Do you stay in the building? Go forth. I mean, that's a natural process. It leads to going forth. When you experience grace, this is where we were last week, when you experience grace, that incredible feeling of being loved, whatever it might be, what do you do with that? You just sit in the center with it? Or does grace lead to gratitude? Again, etymologically related. And that the fact that those words are rooted also speaks to the fact that grace and gratitude really are connected. There's a naturalness about that, I think, that we feel. And that's certainly part of my experience at Holden, being fed and wanting in turn to be in some fashion. It spills out. That's what's so beautiful about it. It's just, you want to empty yourself. This is not, oh my gosh, I've got to give all this stuff up. There's just this desire for emptying, self-emptying, that Pauline word, kenosis, is his way of describing what Christ does. At the center there is a self-emptying. And before I move on to the brothers, I also want to say that yes, it's Christ we meet, but I will tell you that for me, the labyrinth is really, it is a feminine space. I use that word matrix, which is the mother space. It's really, that's what it feels like. And having done this, having been on a pilgrimage with my wife Judy at Chartres, it was profoundly that. And Chartres is Notre Dame. It is our mother space. And I really sense that at Chartres. By the end of our week there, there are these beautiful rose windows that if you take the west wall of Chartres and you lay it down on the floor of the nave, the rose window, the west rose window, would lie right on top of the labyrinth. It's very interesting. All very geometrical, very mathematical. And those rose windows, Mary holding the Christ child, which takes us back to the beginning with the Carlos Fairmont. Mother holding the Christ child. My own experience was that I somehow finally got the idea, as weird as it is for a male, that I am intended to be Mary. We are all Theotokos. We are all God-bearers into the world. We are all supposed to be doing this. And it just was shocking in a way. But somehow it felt spiritually true. And it was because I had been fed, and so on. Now, what does all this have to do with Brothers Karamazov? Well, I've already done that. There are already connections there. The very beginning of the novel, the son who was thought of as the hero, Alyosha, who was the most innocent in some ways, the youngest, his first memory is of being held up by his mother before an icon of Jesus and Mary, Mary holding Jesus. And that memory, the narrator says, these memories from childhood can stay with us and transform our lives. They are seeds. That's a word that comes up over and over again. They are seeds planted in us. One good memory, Dostoevsky says, from childhood can be enough, because that memory is there as an act of love, something very beautiful that you can go back to and you can remember, yes, I remember what this felt like. I can remember this. And this, it was this that I want in my life all the time. And of course, we lose it. The brother Dmitri, who is a military guy, is a sinner, he's a drunkard, I mean, he's a crazy man. But Dmitri, one of the things the novel tells us is that when Dmitri is on trial for having killed his father, which he probably didn't do, but he's on trial for this, there's a doctor in the town named Herzenstube, German doctor in this Russian town, who is testifying on Dimitri's behalf. And Harrington Stupid says, well, you know, I want to tell this story. I have a memory of Dimitri. And that memory is that when Dimitri was a boy, he was coming down the road in front of my house. And he was dressed in rags, the way he always was, because he had no mother and his father didn't care at all about him. Dressed in rags, really just poor and broken down. And Harrington Stupid invited him in and gave him a pound of nuts. And had him recite the Trinity, the Holy, you know, God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Ghost. As if, do this and here's a pound of nuts. And Herzenstube recites this story in a court of law. and says, you know, boy, that boy was, and then years later, when he was grown up, that boy, Dimitri, 20 years later, came back to my house, and he said, Herr Chistuba, I just want to thank you for that moment. I have never forgotten. You're the only person who ever gave me a pound of nuts, who ever gave me anything, and I bless you for it. I thank you for that. That was Dimitri. There was this gratitude for something so small. In the passage that is there before you, we again have, we have a child. And this novel is also about the suffering children. There's a boy, Kolya, who is the younger generation. The novel is about these three generations that represent, in some ways, Russian society. And I go back to that initial question. There was one time peace. There was a garden. There was this sense of beauty. And then something happened. And the Brothers Karamazov is in the middle of that, something that happened. And how do we solve this? Dostoevsky's writing at the end of the 1870s. In 1881, the Tsar is going to be assassinated. Dostoevsky dies. 1905, an attempted Russian Revolution. 1917, the Russian Revolution. Dostoevsky can feel that we are in the edge of a crisis that could be a transformation into an extraordinary society that really bears witness to this underlying truth of Christ, this desire to give everything away for the sake of the other. Or it could be something else, terror and nihilism. And so he has these generations, and the youngest is represented by this boy, Kolya, who is a poet, very smart, and has been trained by good French-thinking philosophers who have quoted to him Voltaire. If there were no God, we would have to invent him. Kolya is about maybe 12 years old. And so, you know, spouting these words, he doesn't fully understand, but he is a rationalist. He's not interested in anything supernatural. And of course, God, the church, I mean, so old-fashioned here. So, at this point in the story, there's another boy, Ilyosha, who is dying. And Kolya has been involved in this process. In some ways, is in part responsible for this. He shunned this boy, Ilyosha, for various reasons. He excommunicated him in a certain sense. He stepped outside of communion with Ilyosha. And Ilyosha is tormented in pain by something that he did. And Kolya has not helped the situation. Ilyosha and Kolya are talking. And something happens to Kolya, in part because Alyosha is someone that he wants to dismiss, but can't quite dismiss. There's something about Alyosha. He wants Alyosha's attention, and he wants Alyosha's approval. So, let's see, how much time have we got? Figure out how much of this we can read. We've got about 10 minutes. So if we move to, I'm going to skip over, near the bottom of page 556, and if someone would just start reading, Alyosha is talking about this boy's family, Ilyusha, and trying to say some things to Kolya. And if someone would pick up with the words, yes, yes, near the bottom of 556, and just start reading, and I will stop you in the middle of the next page. Would someone be willing to do that?
I will if somebody will give me some glasses.
Glasses.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Russian lover that you are.
Yes, yes. When you've come more often, you'll see what sort of being she is. It's very good for you to get to know such beings in order to learn to value many other things besides, which you will learn precisely from knowing these things. Alyosha observed warmly, that will remake you more than anything. Oh, how sorry I am, and how I scold myself for not coming sooner, Kolya exclaimed with bitter feeling. Yes, it's a great pity. You saw for yourself what a joyful impression you made on the poor child, and how he grieved as he waited for you. Don't tell me. You're just rubbing it in. It serves me right, though. It was vanity that kept me from coming, egoistic vanity and base despotism, which I haven't been able to get rid of all my life. Through all my life, I've been trying to break myself.
Of course, this is a 12-year-old boy talking to
me. I'm a scoundrel in many ways, Karamazov. I see it now. No, you have a lovely nature, though it's been perverted, and I fully understand how you could have such an influence on this noble and morbidly sensitive boy, Alyosha replied ardently. And you say that to me, Kolya cried, and just imagine. I thought several times already since I came here today. I thought you despised me. If only you knew how I value your opinion. But can it be that you really are so insecure at your age? Well, imagine. I was thinking just that as I watched you telling stories there in the room, that you must be very insecure. You thought that? What an eye you have, really. You see. I bet it was when I was telling about the goose. Precisely at that moment, I imagined you must deeply despise me for being in such a hurry to show what a fine fellow I was. And I even hated you for it and began talking dribble. Then I imagined it was here just now when I was saying if there were no God, he would have to be invented, that I was in too great a hurry to show off my education, especially since I got that phrase out of the book. But I swear to you, I was in a hurry to show off, not out of vanity, but just, I don't know how, for the joy of it. By God, as if for the joy of it. Though it's an extremely disgraceful quality in a man to go through himself on everyone, neck out of joy, on everyone's neck out of joy. I know that, but now instead I'm convinced that you don't despise me, that I invented it all myself. Oh, Karamazov, I'm profoundly unhappy. Sometimes I imagine God knows what, that everyone is laughing at me, the whole world, and then I'm quite ready to destroy the whole order of things.
Okay, we'll stop there. To me, there's just such astonishing psychological and spiritual insight into Kolya, into this 12-year-old boy, and culminating in that statement. I feel like everyone is laughing at me, and in response to that, then I'm quite ready to destroy the whole order of things. That is, I testify, I know that. And it comes in a confession. Through this conversation, of course, Kolya is only able to own this because Alyosha has seen him. That's what he says. Why? What an eye you have. You see. And I think that's one of the things we hunger for. We also dread it. We do not want to be seen. And yet we deeply want to be seen. And this is Kolya all over. His precociousness, his intelligence, is also a facade, a mask to protect himself. This is a boy who has no father, like the Karamazovs, a distant father. And his mother is more or less absent. And so he has not been seen in this way. And Alyosha does what Dmitri asked of him. You will listen, you will judge, you will forgive. Alyosha stays and listens. He really attends. Attention, he attends. He serves the boy by listening. But he also, when Kolya acknowledges, it was a terrible mistake for me not to come and visit his family who needed me so much. What does Alyosha say? Oh, yes, it's a great pity. You saw for yourself what a joyful impression you made on the poor child, how he grieved as he waited for you. Alyosha doesn't let him off the hook. Yes, this is true. You need to feel the weight of what you have done. You really need, and in terms of a labyrinth, this is part of that process. It is that facing of that truth about ourselves. But then, Alyosha also affirms him. Yes, you are an incredibly bright boy. I see you. And it is out of that context that the boy, Kolya, is able to experience that sense of forgiveness, is able to speak his truth without feeling like I'm going to be excommunicated. I'm going to be shut out from the community. Instead, Alyosha, in a sense, embraces him as a mother, as a father. Oh, Karamazov, I'm profoundly unhappy. This is not the Kolya we meet previously anymore. The Kolya we meet before, and I just was with these kids who are playing these games and doing all these things. And it's so easy to just want to dismiss them because they're rowdy and bumptious, they're not paying attention. But each one of them has a story. And somewhere in each one of them is this Kolya. Right? And I said to those teachers, man, I bless you for what you do, working with these kids. I couldn't do it day in and day out. You know, it's enough dealing with 18 and 22. It's enough. But they each have a story. And that story, ultimately, and it's held within the story of this novel, where there's this pattern, this matrix, this field that we exist within the story. And it ultimately, it invokes truth-telling, but also story, because of its beauty, gives us a sense of healing and peace and beauty, as I think is true of the biblical text. Truth-speaking, but also its beauty gives us a sense of its truth. And with the truck going by, I'm feeling probably out of time, so my thanks. And we have a great if anybody wants to start here.